Welcome to the Taylor Report, CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm Phil Taylor, your host. Our guest today is Masako Yonakawa, and she is a professor and a co-representative of the Japanese nonprofit organization Rita-Congo.org, and a researcher on refugee issues, peace, and conflicts in the Great Lakes region in Africa. Professor, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me today.
You gave a very important speech, in my view, to the Organization for Democracy and Peace, Women's Organization, International Network of Women for Democracy and Peace in Brussels. A very wonderful organization, in my opinion. I'd like to talk to you, of course, about the speech. We read it for our last program. We read the entire text. I hope that we'll also post it. What is your background in working in the, I know you work with refugees in the Great Lakes region. How long were you involved with that? And a little bit of what you, the tasks you had.
Okay. Well, I was in the Great Lakes region for about 10 years. Starting in Tanzania, in the refugee camp, then to Rwanda. I was there from 1995 to 1998 in order to repatriate refugees and to resettle them. Then I moved to Congo, eastern part and in the capital and the western part of DRC. And I was also involved with the repatriation of Rwanda refugees there. Mm-hmm. And I was also in the Republic of Congo and Kenya, etc. But my main, I was mainly working in Rwanda and in DRC.
Yeah.
UNHCR, yeah.
So you've had experience with all the refugees in some way or another in the Great Lakes region. Those from Burundi and Rwanda, and of course those in Congo.
Yes.
In your speech, just to start off, the Victoire Ingabire Award speech, you spoke about Victoire Ingabire herself and the importance of a speech that she gave in 2010. Now, as somebody who has worked in the Great Lakes region with refugees, what was it in your mind that she said that was so strikingly important?
Well, when she arrived in Kigali after a long stay in Netherlands, she said that we have to also think about the Hutu victims, not only the Tutsi victims. And that was a sort of taboo for Rwandans to talk about this, because as you know, Rwanda government's official narrative is that only the Tutsis are the victims of genocide, and not the Hutus. Hutus are falsely branded as genocides. And once you say that, oh, I'm a Hutu, I'm also a victim, then you're immediately jailed.
Mm-hmm.
So for her to say that, oh, we have to respect, think about those Hutu victims is not only, well, she's telling the truth, but that was very, very courageous of her to do that. But this is very, very important, because when you only look at one side of the victims and not forget about others, then you can never implement a reconciliation. And no, obviously that means there'll be no democracy and peace and justice in the country and region. Mm-hmm. But that's why her speech was very important. But because of that, she was imprisoned, you know, for about 8 to 10 years or so.
Yeah, that puts us right into the area that is so difficult. As you mentioned in your remarks, the government of Rwanda is an official position. You cannot say the genocide, you have to say the genocide against the Tutsi.
Exactly.
Now, incidentally, just for historical perspective, actually, that is hasn't always been the case in terms of how it was referred to, certainly by neighboring states, by UN personnel. And there was a, they used to have a different terminology. They would say Tutsi and moderate
Hutu, yeah.
Which I always thought, well, that's a rather odd category.
How do you distinguish between a moderate Hutus and non-moderate Hutus, for example, you know?
Yeah, it was a Hutu, but it was a moderate Hutu.
Exactly.
That was the language of the International Criminal Court, actually. So there is a kind of variance developing in that now the government there is insisting that the term has to be genocide against the Tutsis. And in your talk, you said, you asked the question rhetorically, why am I focused on the Rwandan refugees? So, and what is your answer to that? What caused you to develop a focus?
Well, actually, I didn't really choose to work with Rwanda. I it was purely by chance. You know, when this genocide took place in 1994, I happened to be in South Africa with UN, United Nations. I was there to monitor the election. Then later on, I moved to South Africa, I moved to Somalia, again with the United Nations. That was in July 1994. But remember that at the time, July 1994, there was a massive outflow of Rwandan refugees to neighboring countries.
Yes.
So there is a great need of personnel to assist these refugees. So that's why I was told by UN that, why don't you go to Tanzania? Mm-hmm. Because in Somalia, the mission was shrinking. So I was not, my presence was no longer needed. So that's why I was sent to Tanzania. Mm-hmm. And then after my 6 months mission, I was sent to Rwanda because I was told that, okay, now it's a time of repatriation. And then Rwanda government, the new Rwanda government needs people to resettle these people in order to build a new country. Mm-hmm. So that's why I was sent there. So it was purely by chance, you know. But then when I stayed in the region for 10 years, I started to have a strong attachment to this region. And I thought it was a very special area in terms of international politics. And there's so much greed by the international community, especially in Congo. Mm-hmm. And I found that the more intervention by the international community, the more chaos it brings.
The more involvement, the more chaos.
Exactly. You know, I mean, I'm not talking only about the humanitarian aid or economic aid, but also military operation, you know, this peacekeeping operation, etc. Mm-hmm. So then, and it's to do with economic agenda, meaning that there's a lot of minerals in eastern Congo, and a lot of international community has a desire to have access.
Yeah.
So, and then when during my research, I found that this repatriation, which took place in 1996, 1997, is to do with these minerals. And it's to do with, especially with US government's agenda.
Yes.
Yeah. So it's so really, and so we can't just talk about, oh, refugee issue as a humanitarian issue, but we have to look it into as a political issue, you know?
Yeah, that is, it seems to me, you have a refugee is someone who flees because they're a war is taking place, their property, their life is at stake, and they have no choice but to run.
Exactly.
And you saw the refugees. I've had occasion to see that. These are the stories I hear. I mean, and there's an advancing army, and you don't know what their intentions are toward you, but you know that the government army was fighting them. That's what civilians do in wars. But you mentioned there were great powers watching this whole event, and we need to talk about how the image of a person who was fleeing turned into a person who was a suspect in a crime. My memory is that writers like Philip Gurevich of the United States, there were people with the organization called the Doctors Without Borders. As a matter of fact, I got to ask you very specifically about their role, but they began talking about people in refugee camps as though they were somehow, not deserving of the treatment of refugees. But what was the material basis for that? What evidence? And as a result, a mood developed, certainly in Western capitals, to remove those refugees. Mm-hmm. Now they had, I guess I'm asking you a basket full of questions. They do have rights. Refugees have rights, no matter what somebody in New York thinks of them. There are international conventions on how they are to be treated. Those camps, and if you could tell me about it, those camps were attacked by the Rwandan army.
Yes.
Am I right?
Yes, yes.
And why weren't they protected?
This is a big question. Well, first of all, regarding the refugee movement in general, it is believed that refugees flee because of the persecution or because of the conflict. But in many cases, the conflict actors, they expel the people, aim to expel the people, you know? So, which means that this refugee movement is often intentionally created. Mm-hmm. No, it's not like a natural disaster. It's artificially created in order to expel the people. And this is what happened in 1994 genocide, during the 1994 genocide or aftermath, or its aftermath. Mm-hmm. Rwanda government, RPF, wanted to expel these, especially the Hutus.
Yes.
From Rwanda. And the same thing happened in 1996, 1997, when there's a massive return, forceful return from Zaire and Tanzania. This is also artificially created by the Rwanda government, assisted by U.S. government, you know?
Yeah, that's
you know that, yeah. Yeah. Remember that U.S. government, sometimes they make these policies in refugee movement, refugee flow, for their foreign policy agenda.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so that's one thing. So these refugees who are in refugee camps, yes, they're branded as the genocides.
Yes.
It was generally believed that the genocide killers, genocides,
yes,
were controlling the civilian refugees.
Mm-hmm.
Civilian refugees were taken hostage by these genocide killers, so that they can go back to Rwanda. That's what it was believed.
That was, yes.
Mm-hmm. But this is what happened. When I interviewed many refugees, I learned that this was not true. This didn't reflect the reality. Refugees told me that they're never taken hostage by these, by anybody, you know? And they simply didn't want to go back to Rwanda because they were afraid of the RPF. They had a strong trauma of the RPF who killed their families, their friends, etc. You know? So it's RPF who made this narrative that, oh, it's there are genocides who are controlling the refugee camps, and they're taking these refugees in hostage. That's why RPF has to go there to destroy the refugee camps, which has become so militarized, and to save these people.
Yes.
And this is a very this security and humanitarian narrative are so important in order to intervene into any country, no?
Mm-hmm.
So that's why RPF made up this narrative so that they have a good excuse to intervene into Eastern Congo. But they had an agenda, which was to have access to the minerals, and eventually to install a pro-US government in the DRC under the leadership of Kabila. For that, they use refugees, you know, as I said, for security and humanitarian. So our Rwanda government, army, they intervene in Eastern Congo in late 1996 to destroy the refugee camps. And they also massacre the refugees. And they try to, they repatriate the refugees. But at the same time, there are a lot of massacres at the same time. But at this, during this time, you know, Rwanda, there are a lot of Rwanda refugees who refuse to return to Rwanda. So they fled towards the west, mm-hmm. you know, away from the border. Then this Rwanda army, they chased these people up to western part. And then afterwards, they went down to Kigali to seize power. And this was the aim of the Rwanda government. And during this time, American military, American officers were also present together with RPF. Hmm. And this is not well known, you know?
Yes.
It was a planned operation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm sorry. Unfortunately, American government didn't have any intention to save refugees there, but just to make sure that it seized power and sign contracts with multinational companies so that they can gain access to the minerals.
Yeah, and the tragedy, I mean, this is a low point in many ways, in my opinion, for the United Nations, certainly the division responsible for refugees. I became, conversant with some of this language. I was working in Arusha. For example, simple things that when refugees cross a border, they have to be kept a certain number of kilometers, I think it's 40, away from the border, and then they enjoy international recognition and protection. You know the history, and thank goodness you also mentioned, and I want to ask you about this, but the date that the talk about refugees and genocide is from 1990 mm-hmm. until 1997 at the bare minimum. But in the case of when there were Burundian refugees inside Rwanda, sometimes mm-hmm. Hutu, sometimes Tutsi, that business mm-hmm. of making sure they stayed clear of the border, but then they remained safe. But in this case, the protection was withdrawn. Mm-hmm. And my understanding is that the camps were flying UN flags or flags of the Refugee Protection Service, whatever. Mm. And those flags were attacked. And there had to be quite a lot of loud discussion amongst the people who are supposed to help protect those refugees.
Exactly.
Did they just stand by and it did happen. I mean, it became a disaster.
It did become a big disaster. Well, UNHCR was there, but they, international personnel, I think most of them, all of them fled, they evacuated. So there are only local personnel left behind. But remember that, you know, UNHCR is, how should I say? It's not a really independent organization. It's, you know, because it's totally dependent on donor countries. It's donor countries which make all the policies, make most of the policies, and especially U.S.
By the way, does it vulgarly fall down to the one who gives the most money has the most say?
Oh, of course.
Thank you for that. I hate to say it. I thought it was vulgar.
So U.S. government, I think they had planned for this destruction of refugee camps for some time, together with the Rwanda government. So UNHCR didn't have any power.
Yes.
To intervene, you know.
Yes.
I'm not here to protect UNHCR, but I think it's important to examine more the role of the superpowers, the donor countries, you know.
Yeah.
Which made it policies, refugee policies.
Unfortunately, the great powers of the West were in alignment at that time, and the language used on those refugees, frankly, simply criminalized them. And I have to repeat his name, but the American author Gurevich had the line that, well, it's just the genocidaires holding hostages, and we have to pursue and kill the genocidaires, and that would mean going all the way to, if necessary, to Kinshasa and installing Mr. Kabila in power, who later, of course, had to be disposed of too, to his chagrin, I guess. We're speaking, by the way, to Professor Masako Yonekawa, who has written a great book about the Congo, saying that it has everything except peace. The very
in
good
Japanese, yes, yeah.
Unfortunately, that's the everything part that causes the trouble. I want to raise a name here that I wasn't aware of that you called attention to as somebody who you wanted to note her work, Dr. Harel Bond. She was in refugee studies in Oxford, and I guess she's passed on, but
yes,
you said she opposed the cessation clause. Now, what was that? Tell us about that, how important that was.
Okay, the cessation clause of refugee status means the end of refugee status. So that means that refugees can no longer receive any protection from the host government and from UNHCR. And in some cases, this means that refugees are forced to return to their home country. Mm-hmm. And this means that the similar things could happen to refugees. Similar things could have happened as what happened in 1996, 1997. So forced repatriation, even involving the military, you know. So refugees had a really nightmare of the cessation clause, because they could, you know, send back to Rwanda against their wills and be killed there, you know. Remember that repatriation, it can mean death to many refugees. And this is what happened in 1996, 1997, when the refugees were forcibly refouled to Rwanda. Many were killed upon their arrival, you know, or even jailed or disappeared. So when UNHCR made this policy that, okay, we're going to apply the cessation clause of refugee status to Rwanda refugees, many refugees, all refugees, they just got so scared, and they opposed to this.
Yeah.
And it was very contradictory. This policy was very contradictory, because there has been a lot of reports on the human rights violations in Rwanda, you know, by Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch.
Kibeho had already happened, hadn't it?
Oh, that's 1995. Yeah, yeah.
Uh-huh. Already. Internal refugees, Hutu, were massacred.
Massacre, of course, yeah.
And yet they brought forward the cessation clause.
Exactly. Like normally, the cessation clause means that the country of origin is safe. And there's peace, you know, and the human rights are guaranteed, etc. And there's democracy. But there's nothing, no peace, no democracy, no justice in Rwanda, according to all the reports.
Very illustrates your point.
So that was a very contradictory policy, you know. So that's why, but very strangely, Barbara Harold Bond, and her organization is the only one who opposed the cessation clause, not Amnesty International, not Human Rights Watch, not others. And I actually went to ask one officer in Human Rights Watch, who was one officer who was responsible for Rwanda. So I asked her, so why Human Rights Watch has been quiet? And she said, well, I don't know. You know, she just said, I don't know. And that really surprised me, you know, it shocked me. Because she has been dealing with Rwanda for years, and she was also on the ground, but all she said was, I don't know, you know. But no, but this means that I also asked another officer of Human Rights Watch. He just simply said that this Rwanda refugees is a very complicated case because there are many genocides among the refugees, which is not true.
Yeah, well, by the way, why not simply say, and I'm, my memory is actually, it was taken up a bit early on. They had, as they crossed the border, people with weapons had surrendered them. And you, if you have them in camps, it's a simple matter to go through and identify who you make any claim about and, mm-hmm. and separate a criminal from the others. No doubt mm-hmm. people don't want to be associated with a criminal, no problem. Mm. Why didn't they do a formal, appropriate thing instead of, frankly, it's a this accusation fell on the entire people. You're supposed to accuse the perpetrator. You're not supposed to accuse his family or the people down the
street. Exactly. Well, normally, the Zairean army is supposed to do that. You know, it's supposed to distinguish the criminals and the civilians, but well, we were told that they didn't have a capacity or they didn't have a will. And Mobutu at the time was a friend of Habyarimana, so they were protecting them. It's not very, very clear.
They were spreading the crime. I mean, they were the accusation against the president of Congo was he was a friend of the president of Rwanda,
exactly.
And
it
became a reason to remove him. National sovereignty was just cast aside in all this. We're speaking to Professor Masako Yanagawa, and the other name I want to make sure we talk about, whose work is so important, Dr. Mukwege, because he agrees, he raised the issue, and apparently this offends the Rwandan government. I don't know about the donor countries, but he wants everybody to know about the famous report. I'm sorry.
Mapping report.
Yes.
Mapping report.
Mapping report. How important is his work and his contribution on this subject?
Well, it's very, very important because this mapping report has been a big taboo since its publication in 2010. You know, and you know this was this UN mapping report was made by UN High Commission for Human Rights. But since its publication, the same organization has been kept quiet until today. Not only, also the entire UN community, they have never raised this issue even once. And that makes us suspect what's really going on with UN, you know? Why, if they have published something, why cannot be responsible for taking the action, you know? Because especially they're the ones who made a recommendation that this court should be established impunity should be ended, etc.
My memory of that report, now that you're speaking of it, is that it was originally requested by the prosecutor, a prosecution at the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, where the professors were asked to give a breakdown of the number of dead and then mass graves, et cetera. And when they came back and said that their conclusions were that majority of victims were Hutus, the prosecution didn't want to speak to their own witness anymore.
Oh, is it so? I didn't know about that.
That's my memory. If we're talking about, I think it's Professor Davidson and another from if it's not the same report, it's the exact parallel report where they asked objective personnel. I think these gentlemen were anthropologists, but
But I know that in the 1990s there was a similar investigation, but also by UN High Commissioner Commission. There was a human rights UN special rapporteur called Roberto Garriton.
Mm-hmm.
He and his team tried to investigate what happened to these Rwandan refugees and the Congolese in 1996, 1997. But they couldn't have any access to the to some areas in Eastern DRC or Western DRC, Mbandaka and other places where a lot of massacres or so-called genocide took place, you know. But they found that they did they did publish a report, but I think it was not enough. No, so this is why this mapping report was very important. It was a supplement of this investigation conducted by Garriton and other people. Plus, they interview a lot of witness, etc. So it was a very unprecedented report. So UN should be more serious to deal with this report. But unfortunately, they have kept quiet for the past 10 years now.
Yeah.
Oh, 11 years now, today.
Well, Dr. Mukwege, of course, won the Nobel Prize in Mukwege, is it? I'm sorry.
Mukwege, yeah.
In 2018. And his insistence on the importance of the mapping report has gotten him into serious problems with the government of Rwanda. He's a very courageous man because he works in an area where people have been known to disappear. Who have differences with the president of Rwanda.
Exactly. And remember that there are a lot of human rights activists, lawyers, journalists who have been killed in not only Eastern Congo, but also in Kinshasa and other places. So if you think about what happened to these people, what he's doing is exceptional, you know?
Yes.
I mean, for the Congolese diaspora or Rwanda diaspora to talk about this issue, can be easier,
mm-hmm.
but in doing this in Eastern Congo is you need a special effort, special courage to do that. You know,
courage, just like the courage of Victoire and Ngabire.
Yes.
If you don't mind, I'd like to ask you a few more questions. I know we're taking a lot of your time, but on the point about establishing the genocide, when it took place, et cetera, and who were the victims. I know that you gave up the speech on June 19 to Brussels. Your two other recipients of the prize, one was a Tutsi woman whose family was a victim of the genocide, and a Hutu woman. And I'm curious about your experience with this and my years of interviewing witnesses as an investigator. For Rwandans, the story of use of violence and force, murder, to create refugees began in 1990.
Mm-hmm.
And the writing, Judy Reaver, in her book, In Praise of Blood, and in praise of Judy Reaver, I would say, she documents this is an important chapter of the story. Because of the year 1994, worried about people driven from their homes and people massacred based on ethnicity, they think partly because the International Criminal Tribunal only looked into the year 1994, which is a very mechanical way to go about it, or should say maybe arbitrary, I suppose, a better word.
Mm.
But in 1990, people were driven. Much of the Hutu population was driven out of northern Rwanda by the army of the RPF. And I want to know if you thought about or talked to people, discussed this. They not only were driven out, they were replaced. People crossed the border with cattle and began to move into the homes of those people who lost. Could you talk about your time frame of 1990 and 97, why that's important?
Yeah, what happened in 1994, what happened in 1990 is known to be an invasion of RPF. But you know that RPF is composed by refugees, especially those who are in Uganda. And they these refugees, they established the RPF in order to go back to Rwanda. And even they were also thinking about taking the regime, seizing the regime, even by force, you know? So this repatriate, this what happened in 1990 was not just an invasion. It was a armed repatriation in order to, and not only to just go back home, but also to seize power. So they already had this plan, you know, but this is not well known. Because when we talk about genocide in 1994, many people think that, oh, it's because of ethnic conflict. It's not just a purely ethnic conflict. It's to do with repatriation, armed repatriation, and also seize of power. And also, I would like to, again, highlight the role of U.S. government, because in 1998, there was a big conference in Washington, D.C., assisted by U.S. Committee for Refugees. The director was called Roger Winter. He apparently said that, okay, for Tutsi refugees to go back home, you need an armed struggle. And I'm not sure whether U.S. government really assisted with arms. It's not very clear. But what is clear is that U.S. government assisted a lot of, that they did assisted Uganda government militarily, you know. So probably indirectly, RPF was benefited some military aid, you know. And that's why they're able to invade, repatriate to Rwanda. By force, you know. And as you said, when they repatriated or invaded Rwanda in October 1990, yes, there are a lot of people, residents in northeastern Rwanda, who are expelled. You know, so that RPF was able to occupy that part of the country. So that was very important for them to. For them to organize repatriation of other Tutsi refugees from Uganda and other places, you know. So that's why this repatriation, not only the ones in 1996, 1997, but also what happened in 1990 with the Tutsi refugees who fled in 1959, it's very, very important. It's very, very political, you know. So that's why in my book, I wrote about these two, mainly these two refugee repatriation, what happened in 1990, 1994 with the Tutsi refugees and what happened with the Hutu refugees afterwards, you know? So it's a bit confusing, but it's important to look at and to these two issues, you know?
You know, what you're saying underlines, again, something that Judy Reaver has written. By the way, she also, I believe, is a Victoire Ingabire laureate, certainly
deserves. She is, yeah.
And she used the line that she says, there is an official history, and official history becomes political control, thought control. Mm-hmm. And what you just described is an objective fact. I think Mr. Winters, by the way, has talked about his own role in this.
Yes.
It's not a secret. And what you and I are talking about, because there is an official history, this really isn't supposed to be permitted to be talked about. But if we don't talk about it, we really are, as Judy Reaver says, victims of thought control.
Exactly. So that's why I'd like to come back to Victoire's, Ingabire's speech, important speech. That we should not just believe in the general official narrative, but we have to look into the other narratives, you know, which are forgotten or which are sidelined. You know, these are very important. You know, and we have to also think about why we have to also ask ourselves why they have been sidelined, you know?
Yes.
And normally there's some reasons like that.
Yeah. Well, as yourself, Judy Reaver, others have pointed out, there are places in the world, I suppose, where I know that from my work in Africa, I didn't meet very many Africans who believed these official versions because they live like in Tanzania, they saw what happened. They weren't impressed by the type of court that they saw there. Just one small point on the matter of the refugees driven out when the RPF entered. There's another part of the destruction of a country because they were declared internal refugees and could not receive international assistance, is my memory.
Mm-hmm.
So in other words, it couldn't be a United UNHCR camp for them. Rwanda had to take full responsibility for them. So the army that attacked them didn't take any responsibility and pushed the refugees as a burden onto an already poor government.
Yes. If I'm not wrong, I think MSF, Médecins Sans Frontières, was probably one of the few organizations which are helping these internally displaced persons. But UNHCR was not there to assist internally displaced persons. No, normally, especially in the early 1990s, UNHCR did not deal with these internal refugees. Only those people who fled across the borders were assisted or protected, you know. So yes, so what happened to these internally displaced persons is not well known. And there's not much documents on these people. I tried to look for some documents, but it's very, very difficult. But yeah.
And that contributed, I think any objective study of it would show it contributed mightily to the violence because they lose their homes, farms, they find mm-hmm. themselves on dole, which is not sufficient. And then they are being attacked mm-hmm. by an army that doesn't like them. It's basically a country coming apart, disintegrating.
Mm-hmm.
People
mm-hmm.
begin to act out on their own. It was a very ugly process, but I really appreciate that in your speech, I hope people will read this speech
and thank you.
Make it as widely circulated as possible because you underlined all the points, but it must be understood as a story that begins in 1990 and runs through 97. And thank you very much for mentioning Dr. Harel Bond, that detail is extremely important that she, obviously very well qualified, took up and resisted the cessation clause, which is a disgrace.
Exactly.
Absolutely.
Exactly. And as I told you, she and her organization is the only one who opposed the cessation clause. And I think, I don't know how effective it was, but I think some UNHCR personnel did understand. Mm-hmm. Let me rephrase it. I mean, within UNHCR, there are some personnel who also oppose the cessation clause. That's what I heard. But I think the decision came from the top mm-hmm. or maybe beyond the organization, probably from US, I guess. So they didn't have any choice but to accept it.
Yes.
But when I talked to my former colleagues of UNHCR, some of them did tell me that yes, we're not happy, we're not convinced because the situation in Rwanda was not satisfactory. But there's no other choice, you know. But they couldn't raise their voices as their insiders. So that's why outsiders' role was very important, and Barbara was. And her team was the only one which did that, you know. Mm. Even if it was a smaller organization compared to other human rights organizations like Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, her influence is so big, you know. And we have to really remember that.
Yeah, I think we should work for that. I bet many of her colleagues are very proud of her. that fact will stand out when this whole thing is reviewed in a more sober light, and hopefully not the official sort of propaganda light that it's presently seen in.
Yes.
Professor Masako Yanagawa, we're so grateful you gave us the time. I can't think of anybody more deserving of the Victoria Ingabire Prize. You've done great work, and
Thank you very much.
We can revisit this subject some more, because I have to say, it needs to be talked about a lot. Because I think the dragon likes to sleep and hopes that we will go away. And so we have to come back and poke the dragon.
Exactly. And just to recall you, you know, the refugees, the number of the refugees, the number of those people who are forcibly displaced, it's increasing year by year. Now it's, according to UNHCR, there are 82 million people around the world. I'm not talking about only refugees, but also others, you know. And Congolese have produced a lot of refugees and internally displaced persons. So yes, we have to talk more about these issues, you know.
We definitely do. By the way, people can go to the your site is rita-congo.org. That's rita-congo.org. And I noticed you had said that, and you pointed out that we have 84 million refugees, new ones, and the G7 did not choose to talk about the subject at all.
No, not at all, not at all. Totally ignored.
The G7 is somewhat remote from the 82 million, 84 million. Mm. It's been wonderful talking. Thank you very, very much.
Thank you, Phil, for having me.
Okay, this is Terror Report, CIUT. We'll be right back.